This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from The Fascicle Valley Sounds and Mountain Colors from Master Dogen's Shobogenzo. In the transmission of unsurpassable, complete enlightenment by numberless Buddha ancestors, various practices have arisen. Study such examples as ancient practitioners crushing their bones and Hueka cutting off his arm. Embody in yourself the dedication of a boy spreading his hair on the muddy ground for the Buddha to walk on. Slipping out of your old skin, not held back by past views, you manifest immediately what has been dormant for boundless eons. This very moment manifests, I don't know. Who doesn't know? You have no expectations, and the Buddha eye sees beyond seeing. This experience is beyond the realm of human thought. So this is our Mountains and Rivers session. And I wanted to draw on the Mountains and Rivers Sutra, but I want to save that. It doesn't really need saving, but I wanted to save that for next spring's Ango theme, because we'll be celebrating our 40th anniversary next year. And that sutra in particular was so important to Dada Roshi, and thereby came very important to us, because it he wove it into his teachings in such an intimate way, and based the name of the order on the mountains and rivers, and was so influenced by that. And so We'll come back to that next spring. I was also thinking that next month will be the 10th year anniversary of Dada Roshi's passing, which seems like yesterday and seems like a long, long time ago. Much has happened. So what are we doing here? To live an intimate life. It's part of our, as human beings, perhaps, it's part of our burden, if you will, and part of our blessing that we each want to live a purposeful life, a meaningful life. Nobody wants to feel like their life has been wasted. And more than that, we want to feel like we have been in our lives, lived our life. And yet, a universal experience to more or less degrees, and I think it is more or less, depending on time and culture, is that sense of estrangement. So here we are alive, living. We're in the midst of it. It's happening. The curtain's drawn. The play is in the middle of its acts. And yet, in the midst of it, we can feel distant, alienated, isolated. We're doing the things. We're going through the motions of life. And yet there can be this strange experience that is actually not strange at all, because it is so commonly shared that somehow we're going through our life but not in it. And that is the symptom of something. That's not an accident. Everything that we experience is a result of karma, is a result of actions, is a result of something happening, something taking place. And so when we see a pattern within ourselves, when we see a pattern within all of humanity, we should stop and take notice. What is that something that's happening? And so that way of thinking of the Buddha, or comparing the Buddha to a physician who recognized that there is an illness. And there being an illness, dukkha, there must be causes for that illness. And if we can understand and get to the root of those causes, we can heal that illness. Nirvana, cessation. And what he realized was that pervasive sense that we have of distance, alienation, is a symptom. It causes, so it is suffering itself, and it causes a great deal of suffering. Because the way we react to that, act out on that, basically gives rise to everything. And all along, the Buddha realized in his enlightenment, we're in essence just simply moving against our basic nature. That experience of, that existential experience of somehow being apart from something essential, which appears in many different traditions, understood in its own way, arises because of mind. That it's not, in fact, true. It isn't the basic truth. It's not the situation we're actually in the midst of. The situation we're in the midst of is that everything is unified. Everything is not apart. But the power of our mind and consciousness is such that it creates worlds that are wholly real to us, so real that we create mirrors of that alienation and distance and all the effects of that with our hands, with our words, with our thoughts, with our actions. We create worlds outside of ourselves that reflect back what we're experiencing inside. The Buddha said, in this very body, a fathom long, with its consciousness and perception, I declare, is the world, is heaven and hell, happiness and sorrow, life and death. It's arising, its cessation, and the path that leads to its cessation, all in this very body, all of that. Which is kind of bad news when we're lost because we can't get away from it. But it is very good news when we encounter the Dharma, because what we need is already at hand in total. We're studying the Eightfold Path, this ongoing. So beginning with right understanding, to develop an understanding that is consistent with how things actually are, which in essence is beginning to respond to those questions that we all have, whether they're implicit within ourselves or whether they become explicit to us. Why do we get stuck within these cycles of suffering? Why do those cycles keep cycling? Why, despite our strong willfulness, our various efforts, our determination, do those cycles just keep repeating, as though we're to some degree powerless? How is that an activity of mind? How is it constructed? Being constructed, how does it cease? And why will all of our strategies for bringing together, for resolving or healing that sense of alienation, for finding joy and avoiding pain, why are they all ultimately disappointing? In fact, why within those very strategies are the very already the causes of their failure? And so we begin to develop right understanding. We could think of that as, because we come into practice with such a well-established understanding, whether it's conscious to us or not. That doesn't mean that we, you know, have carefully created a philosophical, you know, system by which we live. We may never have thought about it at all. And yet each of us enters with a very, very intact, well-established, fully functioning understanding of pretty much everything. Even those things we don't understand, we have an understanding of those. And so, and that's what we have faith in. And so because that's where we start, it makes sense that we would need to begin, sort of enter into that realm, conceptual understanding, which has not really been aligned, and we begin to bring it into alignment. Also because that's what we have faith in. And so we're sort of in the arena that we trust, which is thoughts, ideas, concepts. And so it seems quite marvelous that we would begin with right understanding. And also it kind of makes sense. An old master said, concepts are bound together by karmic traces and dispositions. Therefore, we first need to have a conceptual understanding of this process. Then, once we understand it conceptually, we must slowly loosen ourselves from that very conceptual bond. So even though that's where we begin, in the context of the Dharma, you know, in ordinary life, concepts are meant to be built upon and built upon and built upon and built upon and built upon. In the Dharma, their intention is to help establish us so that then the concepts can disintegrate. And in essence, when we might think of when we begin practicing and establishing right understanding, that we're beginning to take charge. We're beginning to engage consciously, wakefully in our lives, based in how things actually are working. The beginning of really being the master of our mind and life, but in a way that's based in and will lead to true mastery and not just control and manipulation and hostile and subtle takeovers and we begin to cease from that which is harmful, to bring forth that which is good, and to study and realize the mind. We begin to engage in a path in which we step by step begin to understand more and more and more this is not a matter of something happening to us. Life is not happening to me. And having begun taking charge, we renew that every day. We engage in that every day with our intention, with our commitment, with our practice, and begin to directly translate or integrate that into everything we do. That's what makes this path unique. You know, lots of us have done things in our lives where we've focused on something, a career, a relationship, something that we really want to develop. We put a lot of energy into it. And often, that's a part of our life. And so we take that study up in some place, a university, a studio, whatever we're giving ourselves to. And then when we step away from it, we step away and we enter back into the stream, other streams of our lives. And what's revolutionary about the Eightfold Path is that there's no stepping away. It is the totality. That's its intention. That doesn't happen in the beginning, right? In the beginning, our lives are like they were before we encountered practice. They're in categories and departments. We ourselves are divided into categories and departments. And so we tend to apply ourselves in practice and then sort of return to everything else. Even though we may have the thought or the mind or the intention to unify this, that habit is very strong. And so it's still, things are still isolated. They're still separate. But over time, that path really does become one. And so as we're studying that through our thoughts, through our words, through our actions, through our livelihood, we're studying the Eightfold Path. We're practicing the Eightfold Path. That's what each of those steps is pointing to. We engage our energy. We could think of right effort in a certain sense as our energy that moves through us, that is present in every moment, that manifests in various ways, mentally, intellectually, physically, emotionally, spiritually. Those energies that are our very body and mind, and are the body and mind of everything. Everything is infused with that energy, that ki, that vital life force. It exists in everything. And what we encounter in the beginning of practice, and depending on our practice and our karma, sometimes this goes on for a long time, is we encounter the unruliness of that energy, the scatteredness of that energy, which most obviously takes its form in distracted thinking, but it's really much more pervasive than that. And that's really the source of so much of our struggle in practice, is when those energies are too wrought, too taut, and they become agitation, excitement, and we sort of break apart, or when they become, and on the other side, very sluggish and dull, apathetic, lazy, our spirit drops. When we were walking Kenyon the other day, I was kind of towards the end of the line, and we were coming around here, and the wind was blowing. It was just one of those in kind of quintessentially autumn days, and the air was filled with ki. And it was just so incredible. And we were coming around here, and Rudy, who was overcharged with ki, came tearing around. He jumped onto the bench leaning against the locust and skidded all the way up because he was moving so fast. He grabbed the trunk with his claws, hung on, brought himself back. It was like he had so much energy. He was just like busting. It's such a delight seeing that. We're trying to bring that in a little bit. What does it mean to live a meditation-based life? To make a life study of mindfulness in every moment so that more and more and more it becomes our basic state. Right? In the beginning, that can just seem wildly unrealistic, like impossibly impossible. But that's why it's so important for us to, you know, hear and read and study the teachings of those who come before us, who speak of this. This is the truth, not a lie. So that we can begin to imagine and gain trust and confidence in such a possibility. And then as we see our own practice developing, you know, if you have moments where your mind settles, where an instant of mindfulness or concentration becomes extended, that's it. Just keep developing that. And so too, as it gets broader and more sustained, it develops in terms of depth and height, we might say. And so Dogen says that in the transmission of unsurpassable complete enlightenment by numberless ancestors who've come before us, various practices have arisen. Very simple statement, but such a profound thing that throughout, because Buddhism has always been about one thing. Living free of suffering, liberating ourselves from everything that binds us. And binding us, we bind each other. Being about that one thing, and over these many, many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, so many practitioners so devoted to this one thing, various practices have arisen, right? Various ways of engaging the Eightfold Path, of understanding it, of developing it, that have continued to evolve, keeping the root intact, have continued to evolve as times and changes have occurred within the world. And so when Dogen brings up these ancient practices of somebody crushing their bones, or a Hwikka cutting off his arm in the story of his coming to study with Bodhidharma, or the dedication of a boy who spread his hair for the Buddha to walk on. So that's a story where the Buddha was walking one day and he came across a puddle, and a young boy jumped out of the crowd and threw down his body and laid his hair down across the mud so that the Buddha wouldn't get his feet muddy. And the Buddha acknowledged this young boy and predicted that he would become, because of this great devotion, this recognition of the Dharma, that he would one day be reborn as an enlightened being. These other practices, you know, the Buddha was explicit in his renunciation of self-destructive ascetic practices. But he also renounced self-indulgence, pleasure-seeking, passive paths. It is a middle path. And so, yes, it is rigorous, it is challenging. There are moments where it is difficult, sometimes more difficult, certainly more difficult than we expected, and sometimes more difficult than we may think that we're capable of. And in those moments, we're meeting, if we're practicing true Dharma, if we're really following within that middle path, which is designed to be healthy, right? It's designed to lead us into a state of good health, really, in all ways. And so when we meet those difficulties, those challenges, sometimes it's the energies that we're struggling with and how they're manifesting or how they're not available to us. Sometimes it's the mind, right? Our desires, our clinging, our wants, our likes, our dislikes, our expectations. Usually it's just a soup of various things. And in that moment, the self appears in dynamic display. And we have the opportunity to see that self arising, because we cannot study it unless it arises. We cannot let it go. We can't examine it, understand it, see into its nature, free ourselves from it, unless it is arising. So it is rigorous, but you know, life is not a picnic either. I mean, just ordinary life. You know, there were lots of times where I was sitting in this hall doing sesshin, feeling like, you know, challenged, it's difficult, struggling, and thinking that it was hard. But then I would reflect back on my life apart from practice, before practice, and realize that was hard too. And that was harder because I wasn't yet on a path. That's a different kind of struggle. That's why it's said that that samsara seems easy in the beginning, but it gets harder and harder and harder and harder. Practice in the beginning seems really hard, but it gets easier and easier and easier. And so these examples Dogen invokes here is not to encourage us to crush our bones. You know, there are koans that deal with this, but they're to be understood in a sense, in a simple way, as what am I willing to let go of? What am I willing to forbear? What am I able to face? Dogen says, slipping out of your old skin, not held back by past views, you manifest immediately what has been dormant for boundless aeons. Isn't that truth? That we're really returning to what has just simply been dormant in a manner of speaking. It's fully present within us. It is our very nature. It is present and alive in each moment. But without realizing it, it seems distant and dim. And so in realization, and as we practice and we begin to awaken to this, there's that sense of something that has always been here, coming forth, no longer dormant. And then he says, and so this very moment of this manifesting immediately manifests as, I don't know. Who doesn't know? You have no expectations. And the Buddha eye sees beyond seeing. And in the text, I is in italics. Who is in italics? You is in italics. Buddha eye is in italics. Why? Why is it I don't know? What is this I? He italicizes it so that we don't, so that we understand that this sense of I is something that is conventional, that is provisional. And so along the path, we meet a lot of manifestations of, I do know. I know who knows. Me. I'm the one who knows. I do have expectations. And in that, we will find a bit of struggle in our thoughts, in emotions, actions, in our relationships. And so there's an importance in creating helpful conditions, environments in which to practice. That's what this is. That's what I imagine most of you do at home in your place of practice, is you try and create a place that is conducive. When I was practicing at home wherever I was before I lived here, for years, I would always try and create a place that I would create a space where I took out all of the interruptions. Right? So if there was, anything on the wall that would become a distraction, I would try and cover it over, right? Because that was the distraction, right? And so I tried to make a sort of perfect place. I never succeeded, of course, but I tried to make a place that was conducive to practice by trying to take away all of the external distractions beyond a reasonable amount. And then when I came here, I remember the first time I came here, it was a Sunday morning, I'm sitting here, and the Doksan bell's ringing, people are getting up, going into Doksan, and monitors walking the Kiyosaku, and I'm thinking, what the? So much noise, come on. And I realized I had built a box for myself, a practice box, right? Which didn't have here for me, right? And so I realized, I'm being stretched. I tried to create this kind of precious, pristine environment in which to practice to compensate for my fledgling awareness, my still developing awareness that was very precarious. And so it really helped me because I realized, I need to stretch rather than make the environment, my stability. I need to be the stable one. Let your own old skin slip away. Skin and everything. Everything that comes with it. And so to really understand which takes time. The completeness, the largeness of actually living a life free of attachment. Because attachments are so established and so pervasive, but also so subtle. So subtle. And so as our practice develops, we are able to see those more subtle attachments more clearly. And that helps us to develop further. And then we see more attachments, more subtly. And as that continues, the world begins to appear more and more as it is. Free, boundless, harmonious, intelligent. Dogen said, in Song, China, there was a man who called himself Layman Dongpo. A literary scholar, he studied the way of dragons and elephants in the ocean of awakening. He descended deep chasms and soared freely through clouds. One night, when Dongpo visited Mount Lu, he was enlightened upon hearing the sound of the valley stream, and he composed this verse, which he presented to his teacher, Zhang Zhong. Valley sounds are the long, broad tongue. Mountain colors are no other than the unconditioned body. 84,000 verses are heard throughout the night. What can I say about this at a future time? Hearing the valley sound, seeing the mountain colors. Direct encounter with the 84,000 sutras. This arises directly from I don't know. I have no expectations. And the Buddha I sees beyond seeing. And so when we're practicing, when we're sitting and the self arises, you're practicing in the basic instruction of Zazen, in the essential. Basic here doesn't mean beginning. Basic means complete. In the complete teaching of Zazen, which everyone is given the first time they're given Zazen, we practice, I don't know. I have no expectations. That's how the practice is offered to us, is to practice just that way. And so to reflect on that as an example or as a guide to how to practice Zazen and Sesshin, to practice continually letting go of every form of I know, to continually free ourselves from having no expectations, from seeing in a limited way. And losing our, beginning to loosen our infatuation with our thinking mind and our thoughts. To lose our infatuation, the Buddha said we are enchanted with our thinking mind. I mean, it is pretty impressive, right? It's kind of amazing, right? It is so powerful. And yet, within our delusion, its power is so often not well used. That's the problem. That's so much of the mess we've gotten ourselves into. We have such power, and we're not using it well. And so, in sitting and giving yourself to the breath, right, into the experience of the breath, or into a koan or into shikan taza, it means having a basic sense, a confidence in what your practice is, but not knowing the rest. Don't know what the breath is. Just experience it. Don't know the koan. Just enter into it. Don't know what awareness is. Just be that awareness. And that when things arise and we say that we acknowledge them, we meet it, we see it, we experience it in a moment of seeing. that we are encountering that phenomena, that aspect of self, but without possessiveness, without ownership, and in not knowing. We're just, the practice is to just meet that phenomena. That's why we don't elaborate, write a story, judge, because that's all of the stuff of knowing and expectation. And, you know, we hear this over and over again in the teachings, don't know. Don't know mind. Letting go of expectations. And the reason, when we hear teachings over and over and over, it's because they are so important. They're so important. They're so fundamental to how we need to be practicing. The danger is that hearing them over and over, we become dead to them. We're not really hearing. Or we just think, yeah, okay, I've heard that already. Something new, please? And so we have to really keep renewing our mind, our inquiry into these teachings that are offered over and over again. What is I don't know? What is not having expectations? How do you have great aspiration, but without expectation? And so, Dongpo heard the sounds of the morning valley, a bird song, a rustling robe, the thwack of the kiyosaku, a car on the road. Each of these are the 84,000 sutras, right? The voice of the Buddha, the long, broad tongue, pure expression of reality, of suchness, complete in their Dharma state. He saw the mountain colors as none other than the unconditioned body, the night sky, the trees dancing in the wind, the candlelight on the altar, oatmeal in your bowl, the undying body and form of the Buddha. And so that's why we can't try and see this with our eyes, and yet it's through our eyes that we're looking. That we can't hear it with our ears, and yet it's through our ears that we're listening. So it's a different kind of seeing and hearing than a scientist or a poet or a painter or a naturalist. Dongpo says, what can I say about this at a future time? How will I speak of this? Speak of it with your every action, with your walking, with your sitting, with how you pick something up, with how you put something down. You know, we give a lot of attention to how we do things, how you put your hands in gassho, how you hold your hands in shashu, how you sit in the posture of the Buddha. All of this is about mind. It's all about your energies. There are energies in every moment, in every gesture. How you put your shoes on the shoe rack. It's not just about, you know, ducks lined up in a row. It's not about being orderly. But it is about a disorganized mind and bringing that into its natural state. And that as we practice, if we really engage in it, we will see why those things are valuable, why they're helpful, how they do actually bring forth energy. So how we take this posture of the Buddha, how we hold our hands, you know, how we engage in practice actually brings something forth within us. It's all energy. And there is a middle path to that, right? It's not neurotic. It's not overly fussy, right? when the Buddha spoke of meticulous effort, he didn't mean, you know, like crazy. It's mindful. It's so present that there is this. And that in that disorganized, this is completely present but lost to us. And so then that action becomes lost to us. And so Sesshin, one reason Sesshin is so important is because it gives us a way of practicing all throughout the day. So from the moment you wake up, all throughout the day, as you're going to sleep, right? Dogen said, the tongue of the Buddha does not take a break. The colors are beyond coming and going. In other words, the sound of the valley stream is always singing. That song, that sutra of the Buddha is always sounding, is always able to be heard. There is no interruption. It doesn't turn off and on. They're ceaseless. And in that ceaselessness, when we practice ceaselessly, then finally, we can rest. We can rest. We think that when we take a break from being mindful and aware, that's resting. But all too often, that's just returning to a state of unrest. Dogen says, open your minds to mountains flowing and to water not flowing. Understand flowing and not flowing. Understand life and death and no life and death. Understand thought and no thought. He says, Dongpo had this awakening soon after he had heard a teaching by his teacher about insentient beings teaching the Dharma. Although Dongpo didn't leap when he heard his teacher's words, towering billows flew into the sky upon his hearing the sounds of the valley. So when he heard the teaching of the insentient from Changcheng, he didn't leap. He listened, but he didn't yet hear. But when he suddenly heard the sound of the valley stream, then billows flew into the sky. Dogen says, was it the valley sounds or the tide of awakening that jolted Dongpo into awakening? Why at that moment? Why at that moment did he hear it? It had been sounding all the time. You know, it's kind of like when you've got a violin. If it's not tuned, then when you pluck one string, right, the other strings may or may not resonate. But when the violin is finely tuned and it's a fine instrument, then when you pluck one string, the other strings vibrate. And we're like that. We have a fine instrument, and when we tune that instrument, right, through practice, then in such a moment, we see something. We've seen many times before, but now we see it. We hear something. We've heard over and over, but now we hear it. And it's not necessarily an enlightenment experience, but we hear in a new way, in a different way, in a way that is intimate. That separation, that alienation is beginning to shift. And it's really important to appreciate that, to recognize that is something is happening. And that while many of us can have, you know, moments that come and go sort of randomly, accidentally, or so it seems, within practice, that becomes more and more your body and mind. Because your mind is in tune. Dogen says, in general, when we're a beginner, we can't really fathom the Buddha way. It's very difficult to understand. Our assumptions don't hit the mark, right? What we think, how we understand, doesn't really hit the mark. And most importantly, it doesn't awaken us, even if we understand correctly. And then Dogen says, the fact that we can't fathom the Buddha way as a beginner doesn't mean that we lack ultimate understanding, something that has been dormant for eons. We all have that ultimate understanding. It's simply that we don't yet recognize the deepest point. We aren't yet fully in harmony, able to vibrate with that encounter. And so Sesshin is really just carrying on, in a sense, life as usual. Eat, work, clean the dishes, sit, walk. But it's doing so moment to moment within that ultimate understanding, trying to awaken that dormant nature to recognize the deepest point and to tune. So every moment you're practicing, you're bringing yourself into attunement. That's why delusion is hard and painful, because we're not in a tune. Our energies are whacked out, right? So simple things are difficult. That's why the Buddha Dharma is the great medicine, why the Buddha was the great physician. And so let's keep practicing this Sesshin, really trusting this Dharma deeply. Because, you know, the more you trust it, the more you'll throw yourself into it without reservation, without hesitation. Like throwing yourself into the arms of someone you know will catch you.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JIZOPROJECT.